The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. So, yesterday I finished teaching our second in-person 7-day meditation retreat. And it was kind of special to be meditating with people for, living with people for 7 days. But I usually find it pretty special to be on these meditation retreats. But I want to tell you a little bit of one of the things that I find quite wonderful about it, that it's also true for an everyday meditation, but it kind of expands outwards or more intensified or fuller in on a meditation retreat. And that is that it starts with this principle, and that is that the ways that we live, the ways that we are, that harm other people, the ways we live that are kind of not wise ways of living, unwholesome, we say in Buddhism, that they are born from a distracted mind. When we sit to meditate, we're trying to not be distracted. So we're constantly meeting ourselves. In meditation, we're discovering how we wander off in thought, how we get preoccupied. And not that we're always distracted in meditation, but we certainly, that's one of the lessons we learn about how often it is that we get swept up in thought and we come back and start again. And we run into all kinds of challenges, especially on retreat. People's, their knees hurt, their backs hurt, all kinds of memories come back that have not been processed well enough before, so they're still being processed. Maybe they happen, a conflict you were in the week before the retreat, or maybe something 20 years ago that still festers. Maybe there's someone in the retreat that irritates you because they're making too much noise for you. And so in all these situations, the mind can get distracted, caught up in those things, and distracted from the work of being in the present moment, really being here. The practice is to keep showing up here in the present moment and overcoming the distraction. But if the unwholesome ways of behaving and thinking are born from distraction, then when we come out of distraction, we're stepping away from that this part of the source of unhealthy, unwholesome kind of ways of being. And even if it's something that is happening in the present moment, that maybe there's good reason to be challenged by it and not, no fault of your own, because we keep trying to show up and be present, the rumination, the lingering in, the festering, the picking at the scabs, the reactivity, the justifications, the imagined conversations we're going to have, we keep stepping out of it to be in the present moment. And so the influence of all those kinds of ways of thinking kind of begin to lessen and disappear. So what happens in the process of that is what people are left with is what's best in them, is their goodness. And what you see on retreat, especially where it's so concentrated, the best in people comes to the foreground. And even if people think that they don't recognize it for themselves, as a teacher, I can see how much people are trying to be honest, how much people are trying to show up, how much sincerity there is to try to work with the preoccupied mind, the distracted mind, the reactive mind, the angry mind, the fearful mind, all these forces of distraction. And so the tendency to get swept away in anger or rage or fear or greed or desire lessens dramatically as we kind of are learning to let go of the distractions. And if we're not distracted, then the seedbed for unwholesome behavior has lessened dramatically. And you start seeing how beautiful people are. You start seeing the goodness that's there. And this is a remarkable thing, this principle that if it's true that a large part of our unhealthy way of thinking and acting in the world is born from distraction, certain kind of distraction, certain kind of way of being separated from ourselves, being disconnected from ourselves, being fragmented by the distractions, returning to mindfulness, returning to the present moment, returning to a kind of sense of wholeness in the present moment of being present, then the unhealthy tendencies become weaker. And what replaces them? It would be nice to say that just all the healthy motivations, all the goodness that we have in us. And that's kind of true. But what are you left with when you're no longer distracted? What are you left with when you're no longer partial? So there's a number of things. One thing we're left with is we get to see much more clearly the cost of some of our mental behavior and also some of our, conduct in the world as well. And we start seeing that when we get distracted by greed, or we get distracted by anger or resentment, or distracted by anxiety, that the cost of that is not very comfortable. It's not very pleasant. And that begins puts a question mark kind of behind the authority of these distracted tendencies. So we see, is it really worth it? Who am I trying to benefit here by simmering in my resentment? The person I'm resenting is nowhere to be seen. They don't know I'm resenting them, which is a real pity, isn't it? I mean, what good is resentment if the person you resent doesn't know it? And so the cost is you're causing suffering to yourself. And so we start seeing this, if you use a kind of unfortunate analogy for meditation, maybe, the cost-benefit analysis of some of our behavior, some of what goes on in our mind, when we're no longer distracted from ourselves, we get to see that the cost-benefit and analysis not in our favor, to be fragmented, to be distracted, to be involved in these unhealthy ruminations and thoughts of the mind. That doesn't mean that it's easy to stop doing it, but it's a powerful lesson to have. Oh, this is not worth it. I don't think I believe in this anymore. Because before doing some kind of introspective work like meditation, people unconsciously believe the value of rumination and thinking and distraction and trying to solve and fix their lives through that way. But if you don't believe in it anymore and you're still doing it, things begin to shift and change. We're not 100% behind it. We're not committed to it. And so something else begins to happening. We start pausing, we start not acting on some of, not saying some of the things we want to say, not acting on some of the things we want to do. And things begin to take a different turn for us. When we're not distracted and we're here in the present moment, we also start becoming more aware of the goodness or the benefits of the opposite of being distracted. We start feeling that, actually, it feels better to be present in a relaxed way than it is to go back up into those ruminating thoughts, those distracted thoughts. Now, it might seem boring to not be in the distracting thoughts. It's kind of fascinating, interesting to be resenting someone or being fantasizing about desires and all that. But then it turns out that if you pay careful attention, boredom itself is kind of a distraction. It's actually a subtle form of rumination, of thinking, that is also kind of distracting. And we start seeing these subtle ways that we fragment ourselves or pull away from ourselves or cut ourselves off. And so then if we stop, begin letting go into the present moment more and more and have a kind of intimacy in the present moment that's not possible when we're distracted, not possible when we're ruminating, we start slowly not only feeling, we start feeling how good it feels not to be tense, not to be stressed, not to be, to have lost a kind of inner freedom because, you know, fear has taken over, anger has taken over, greed has taken over. And he starts feeling there's a kind of goodness, a kind of a peacefulness, a kind of healthy feeling that begins feeling here. And people start feeling more settled, more at home in themselves, more available, more attentive and aware of the people around them. Less inclined to ignore people, because when we're distracted, we're also not only ignoring ourselves in some way, we're also not really, we're kind of ignoring others, or ignoring the wholeness of the other people. We might have desires for other people, or animosities for other people, but these are all partial ways of taking people in. We don't take the whole person in. And so as we stop being so distracted, we take more of ourselves in, more other people in, and more of the situation that we're in. And that feeling of connection, of camaraderieship, of mutual kind of care for our humanity is a beautiful thing. So slowly, in meditation, it tends to diminish the unhealthy ways in which our mind operates. And it starts slowly bringing out the healthy parts. And that slow process is faster on retreat. Because a meditation retreat that we do, people are meditating, you know, good part of the day. There's something like about 9-10 periods of meditation a day. So there's a lot. And then there's walking, that's sitting meditation, and there's walking meditation in between sometimes. And so there's a lot of this dedication. So much of the day is to either being undistracted or attempting to become undistracted. And if that doesn't work, a good part of the day is discovering how much you are distracted. Wow, I'm really caught up here. And in a way that we don't do in daily life often when we're working and taking care of our everyday life. And so what I see, because I get to meet with, as a teacher, I get to meet people. It's so beautiful to watch the arc of a 7-day retreat. And you just see that more and more the beauty of people comes to the foreground, the goodness in people. And And people sometimes tell me, Gil, you just see the best in people. As if that's a mistake, that's a problem. I think it's pretty special. It's pretty inspiring to know that there's so much goodness in people, so much wonderfulness, and that people are capable of so much kindness and warmth and care and sincerity. I find that it's kind of very inspiring for my appreciation of people and humanity and what's possible. So what if we can do that more? And maybe that's what we're trying to do here, is not only in ourselves but in others, is to bring out the best in us, to bring out the best and support the conditions that allow the best in everyone to come forth. And some of that is that as we begin recognizing it in ourselves, we might be better able to recognize it in other people as well. And if we appreciate it in others, it tends to support others to be that way as well. Anyway, so that was my inspiration coming out of this retreat. And so the principle is that all unhealthy ways that we relate to ourselves and to other people probably has some source in a distracted mind. And what happens if you're no longer distracted? That's the question. So we have some time now, and I'm delighted to have you here. And if you have anything you want to ask or any questions about meditation practice or anything that's related to what we do or to what I've said today, or if you have a testimonial about what I said, this is lovely to hear from you as well. Yes, and if you would say your name when you start, that would be nice.
Hi, I'm Charles, and thank you so much for the talk and the sitting. My question is, what does an undistracted mind look like?
What does an undistracted mind look like? I can give you an unsatisfying answer first. And the unsatisfying answer is that's your task to discover. And I'll try to give you a more satisfying answer. I think an undistracted mind is a mind that begins appreciating how the mind doesn't live in conflict with itself. The mind discovers how to be at peace. How does that sound? You want to ask more?
I got to sit with that.
You sit with that? Great, thank you.
Before he asked the question, my name is Jay. Didn't the Buddha also say something about, I remember in some other talks, in terms of the undistracted mind, he had given analogies of like a lake.
I forgot to put my hearing aids in, so if you can talk just a little bit louder and a little slower for
me. I think even my mask was sort of muffling it. In some other talk, maybe you were talking about, in terms of the following up on the distracted mind, I thought the Buddha gave some analogy also of like a lake or something. Is there something like that?
Yes. There's a lot of analogies, metaphors using water for the mind. And at different stages of meditation, the mind and our body also begins to feel a little bit like how a lake might feel. A lake can feel something. So at one point, the surface of the lake can be very, very peaceful, no waves at all. It just feels like completely still and clear. Sometimes there's a very embodied feeling of being very settled, but there's a flow of energy inside that feels really good and pleasant. Some people describe it as kind of joy or bliss, but it is energetic and has a kind of a flow. And that's likened to a underwater spring that's bringing fresh water into the lake. And just kind of imagine an underwater fountain that's kind of bringing, just refreshing the lake. And then as the meditation gets stiller and quieter, there, all the movement, that of that the wonderful kind of sense of vitality and movement that can, might happen there, quiets down. And then it's a very still, quiet lake. That the analogy is that it's a lake full of lotus blossoms that are, some are, most of them are underwater and some are above water. But the ones underwater, no part of the blossoms, the lotus plants are not lovingly touched by the water, the still, refreshing, supportive water. And so I don't know if those kinds of metaphors or analogies work for you, but that is one that's used sometimes for deep meditation.
Actually, a question on walking meditation.
Yeah.
So I've done some Goenka retreats as well, where there's no walking at all. It just sits, sits, sit. And definitely in the, you know, spirit rock tradition or here, there is walking. And in my head, I get a general sense that walking is almost treated like a stepchild, or it's not as high as sitting.
Uh-huh.
Is there any truth to it? And I was also curious, like in Buddhist time, was it treated as equal as sitting, or is it like you do it only when you can't do sitting or something like that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we do know that the Buddha did walking meditation, and that was taught. And then we knew that the Buddha, when he was teaching meditation, he was teaching it in four postures. That it was, but the most common one seems to have been sitting meditation, but in walking meditation, standing meditation, and lying down meditation. They all work well. They all have their benefits, and they all have their little more challenges. What we do on retreat is we alternate between primarily sitting and walking, but some people do lying, some people will do standing meditation. And it's very, very powerful to alternate. You get some of the benefits of both, and different things, different psychophysical processes inside tend to get stronger in one more than the other, and they tend to balance themselves out. So, for example, if you sat all the time, many people would find it, their mind get kind of dull and it's hard to keep the energy up. But if you walk, it tends to be energizing. But if you walked all the time, you wouldn't be able to get as calm. And so, but they, by going back and forth, you get the best of calm and energy and keeping those in good balance that allows the meditation to go further. And there's other things that come into balance as well. And so we're big on going back and forth, and it's a long tradition in Buddhism to do walking meditation. And if you go to some of the monasteries, especially the forest monasteries, you'll see in the woods they'll have these paths that are really well-worn paths because there've been people walking on them for maybe centuries, but they're only about 30 or 40 feet long, and it's their meditation paths where people have walked back and forth, and it's kind of touching to see them.
Thanks, that was great. Thanks a lot.
One of the advantages of walking meditation is that it's a little bit more like daily life. Many people do a lot of walking in daily life. So if you get the hang of meditating while you walk, it's easier for some people to bring the meditative mind, the mindful mind, into their daily life because they can bring it into their walking.
Hi, thank you. My name is Ambuj. I'm going off the walking meditation. How would you advise doing walking meditation?
How do I advise?
Advise, like how to do a walking meditation.
How do you walk? Great. So the classic way for us is to find a walkway, someplace you can walk, where there's not a lot of visual stimuli. Like, probably don't do it downtown in the middle of, you know, people going to work. Someplace that's pretty calm. And find, and it's about 30 or 40, 20 or 30 paces long. And then simply walk back and forth. And whereas in seated meditation, our primary focus would be, in our tradition here, is to focus on the breathing. And there's something about the rhythm of breathing. Anything that's rhythmic in the body tends to make a nice focus of attention because it keeps the mind relaxed and focused. If it's something that doesn't move to focus on, the mind tends to get tight. But because it kind of has a nice kind of rhythm, the mind kind of follows it and It's kind of like if you're looking at a river going by, just sitting on the mat because of the river. It's kind of very relaxing to watch the flow and the movement. So we're watching the flow and the movement of the breathing. In walking meditation, the rhythm that we're tuning into is the rhythm of the feet and legs alternating as they walk. And it's usually, if you're walking fast, then the sensation is mostly just feeling the soles of the feet against the ground as they hit the ground. But if you're walking slower, then you're paying attention to the flow of sensations that come into place as you lift and move your foot forward. And some people say that's pretty pedestrian. It's pretty boring to just simply put your attention there. But it's not that the sensations are necessarily so fascinating. What's fascinating is the clarity of attention that builds up when we're able to keep the attention in a relaxed way right there. So one little image that I tend to teach that helps support that is imagine that your feet are sponges. And like a sponge, you put sponge in water, it soaks up the water. So if the feet are sponges for sensations, so you just kind of feel that you're just receiving the sensations that come as you walk, and just receiving and taking them in, and that becomes the primary object of attention. The mind gets distracted, you go back to that. That's a brief instruction.
Thank you.
And then we walk back and forth, if you walk slow enough, it's nice that when you come to the end to stop, turn around, stop, and then start. And what the stopping does is that you're much more likely to notice that you've gotten caught up in thought, and then you start over again. And this starting over again is really a big part of any kind of meditation, and learning how to start over so that the starting over doesn't agitate your mind. Because some people are like, oh no, I got distracted again. Oh, I'm a terrible meditator. And oh, I got to try again. I don't know if I can, it's so hard. By the time you go all through all that, the mind is so agitated, so you stirred it up, right? So learning how to start over again. Oh, look, it would be more like, oh, my mind is distracted. Okay, I'll start over again. I'll just begin again. Okay, here we are. And so the difference between those two mindsets, one supports more meditation, one doesn't.
My name is Padma. I think I'm trying to figure out, I notice the distractions, and then I try to come back to the breathing. But how, and then you just explained the walking meditation, which I had the question about. Thank you for that. But if the distractions...
Okay, hold it right.
So if the distractions are more like resentment, the silly thoughts, of course I notice them and it's like, okay, silly, right? But how do you go about with more like life trauma-related distractions?
Trauma. Oh, so... Probably with trauma, it's a big question. And so we have to be very careful about how we work with it. If it's a lot of trauma, you should work with a trauma counselor. But if I think it's best not to treat trauma as a distraction. I think if you treat trauma as a distraction, it kind of accentuates the wound. But some people, if they turn towards the trauma and feel it, also makes the trauma, the wound, bigger. So the art of it is how do we open up to the trauma without being hurt more by it? And that takes a lot of care. And so one of the ways, there's a number of ways to do this, but one of the ways is to open to the trauma, be present for it, for a very short time, just almost like imagine your mindfulness is like soft cotton gauze, like soft cotton balls, and you go feel the physical experience of trauma that resides in your body, and you just kind of gently touch the trauma, maybe 3 times with awareness. So I know you're there you are, and then you pull back, and then maybe you do a little bit of metta, loving kindness, to kind of stabilize, or maybe go back to your breathing and just stabilize. And then if it feels like it's useful again, go with that soft cotton gauze and say, okay, trauma, I know you're there. And the idea is to show the trauma that you can be present for it in a safe way, that you're not afraid of it, and you're also not reacting to it, you're not attacking it, you're just there in a friendly way. And then you come back to your breathing, and you do that. And you don't have to do it, don't have a big agenda, don't try to work too hard at it. So that's one thing you can do with trauma. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it requires more me practicing that, right?
Yeah.
So I'm hoping, so I'll be coming to the retreat, the next one, so hoping that'll help.
Great. Well, if there are no more questions or something, then let's sit for 5 minutes and then we'll call it an evening. A distracted mind has very little room in it because it's kind of become claustrophobic with its preoccupation. Or narrowed or crowded, I guess that's a better word, crowded with its preoccupation. An undistracted mind has more room, more space in it. And one of the things it has room for is love. And what does it feel like when there's room for love? Thank you very much. And I look forward to a chance of being together with you again.